As we continue to say goodbye in our hearts to Karen and take these next steps as a community of faith, I suggested last week that we have two tasks that we must accomplish together as this community. The first, I said, was to become aware again that as a church, we are on a journey, and we have always been on a journey. Whichever way we decide to go tomorrow and the next day, we are sailing our boat on a river that we've always been on, and we don't know what lies around the next bend. Nonetheless, we are going to explore wherever this journey might take us because we are intrepid journeyers here at MPC. We're explorers in our own right. In the quartet's poem that I shared last week, T.S. Eliot said two things about journeying. He said, "To make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we always start from." We are certainly at both an end and a beginning here today. And Eliot ended that poem by saying, "We shall not cease from exploration. And at the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive at the place we started and know it for the first time." We are back once again where we started, and we know ourselves much better now than we did 12 years ago. When I was at the GTU, I was privileged to take a preaching class from the Reverend J. Alfred Smith, Jr., who's the pastor emeritus now at Allen Temple Baptist Church in Oakland. Many of you know that place. It's an amazing place. In his lifetime, he grew it from 600 members to something like 12,000. And it's situated in one of the toughest neighborhoods in East Oakland. He knows something about connecting with the community of faith and the life of the people around him. And he said this in our class about what a sermon is or must have. He said it must have three things. It must have a tear, it must have a smile, and it must have a task to do. That kind of stuck in my heart when I was in his class. And as I was preparing these two sermons that I'm doing this month, I began to realize that what Reverend Smith said also applies to a community such as ours. We do indeed have a tear in our eye as Karen is making a new step on her journey of discovery and ministry. And we have a smile, too, at all of the joy with which we have been blessed here at MPC. And we also have a task to do as well. So if reawakening our sense of journey is the first part of our task, then the second part of our task, I think, is this: to articulate who we are as a community of faith while we begin making these next steps of our journey. And I use the word articulating or saying because saying who we are involves more than simply gaining an awareness of where we may have been or even embracing an awareness of where we are today. Articulating our self-understanding involves discovering more than we thought we knew about where we have been and more than we currently imagine about where we are today. But saying who we are also, very importantly, involves engaging an imagination of where we might go tomorrow. Another pastor I met once asked me, "What is the DNA of your church?" And that stuck in my mind too. I think it's a very good metaphor when thinking about articulating who we are. I think who we are is a combination of what we bring or brought into this world, and it's intertwined with what we seek to be in the world as well. Who we are is a product of both our nature and our nurture. And it's also an opening up to discover what the Spirit of God might do within us tomorrow. Now, when I was first studying pastoral counseling some 25 years ago, there was a psychologist named Eugene Genlin at the University of Chicago, and he was among a notable group of thinkers, psychologists and theologians and sociologists and the like, and they were theorizing in those days about religion and society. In particular, they were writing about the emergence of this field of counseling psychology and how it was beginning already then to displace some of the functions that churches had already done over the years in society before. Gendlin and his colleagues were writing about what made counseling a process of self-discovery. And at that time, counseling had been growing for some 2 decades, but at that time was just exploding onto the scene, emerging as a huge new field of theory and practice, largely breaking away from those early 20th century Freudian analysis roots. Some of you here, I know, were a part of that early work in new theories of counseling. Gendlin proposed that we humans make our meaning in life by putting words on our deeper sense. He called it our felt sense of what we already carry around and know to be true in our bodies and our souls long before we're consciously aware of it. He argued that the process of putting our feelings and our beliefs into words actually focuses our meanings. It focuses what we're about. And it makes our meanings even more powerful because it makes our meanings in life something that we can access consciously now and something which will deeply empower us in our lives. And if you have ever been in counseling or if you've ever had a good and trusted friend with whom you can talk, you know that talking about what it is that's inside you is healing and transformative and clarifying. There is something about putting into words that which we already feel, which transforms us and makes us to grow. Now, as I was thinking about that, because that was some time ago, I was thinking that that book came out a few years after what is at that time had been called the Human Potential Movement. And many of you here can remember being around during those times and being involved. I was in high school and college during those years, and that kind of stuff, the idea of human potential, really grabbed my imagination. The theme in one form or another was evident in poetry and song, story and myth, all of my adolescence and early adulthood. And I remember thinking that when I left high school, I wanted to make a journey of self-discovery. We called it finding yourself. Remember that? I wanted to find myself. When I left home, I thought that I was going to make maybe a long trek, certainly a long trip, and I would find myself. I imagined that I would take along my Cat Stevens records, my Richard Brautigan poetry, and my Hermann Hesse novels, and go off and find myself. And if you told someone in those days that you were going to go off and find yourself, pretty much everyone knew what you meant. You didn't really have to explain it. Of course, I mean everyone. I mean your friends and your peers, because your parents didn't have a clue what you meant by the term finding yourselves. And if they did have any kind of an idea of what finding yourself means, they would alternate either laugh out loud at how silly you sounded or become terrified at what might happen to you if you were to find yourself. We called that lack of mutual family understanding the generation gap. And to our great surprise, when most of us had kids later on, we couldn't figure out why our kids didn't think we were so hip after all. Life is a circle. I think, in hearing that scripture passage, that Jesus might have had a better understanding of what we were going through than our parents did. And that may truly be a part of why adolescence and young adulthood is a particular time of most people's lives when they're open again to spiritual experiences. So like many of us here today might consider ourselves, Jesus was seen by nearly everybody around him as some sort of radical. He was always going cross-grain to what was happening in society, and he frequently went off in entirely new directions of understanding that left everyone around him baffled. Jesus, I think, must have known a great deal about this issue of saying who you are. Think of the passage we just heard from Luke. Jesus asks his friends in a quiet moment about his followers. Who do all those people who come and listen to me say that I am? And the disciples answered that pretty much everybody thought he was one of the prophets of old who had come back to life. Now, I think Jesus was asking that identity question in a nutshell. I think that he was actually asking a focusing question as well. People considered him to be something, but what they considered him to be may or may not be who he really was. And if they were wrong, they would develop expectations of him and his work that would end up being unrealistic. And we know from reading those historical stories that just about everybody around Jesus expected him to be a different kind of radical than Jesus understood himself to be. The people in first-century Palestine were looking for a new David in their Messiah. They were looking for a conquering hero who would overthrow the theocracy in Jerusalem and then drive out the Romans. And we know from reading the rest of the book, it didn't turn out that way at all. But on the other hand, if the disciples, or at least Peter, were right in their understanding about who Jesus was, they too could end up with expectations that didn't match up with the reality of what he was asking them to do. Think of Peter being the one in the garden who went out and attacked the guards after Jesus had told him not to. Having the right name for that person didn't mean they had the right idea about what he was here to do. I think Jesus could have asked a clarifying follow-up question for Peter. He might have said, "Okay, Peter, you call me the Holy One of God. What is it you think I'm going to be doing here on earth?" I think that is a question that we are still arguing over in the church today. What is it that we expect God to be doing here on earth, and what's our part in it? Even if we did know, it doesn't mean we would end up doing whatever it is that we thought that God wanted. Because another great part of being human is that knowing what we need to do doesn't necessarily empower us to do what we need to do. One psychologist I read several years ago said that if pointing out our faults was all that we needed to do to make positive change in our lives, we would all be self-actualized masters of our own identity. We'd be fit, we'd be healthy, and we would have peaceful and loving relationships with our family. Every day, we forget that. Every day, we not only don't do at least some of the things that we can do to improve ourselves and the world around us, but surprisingly or not surprisingly, we insist on pointing out the shortcomings of those around us as if that's all that they needed to do or hear in order to improve their lives. The reason I think that Jesus was asking those kinds of focusing questions was that Jesus was not in the business of waging war. He was in the business of waging peace, and peace through some sort of inner transformation. His message was one of inviting people to slowly begin to change into the kind and loving people who would live their lives under the law of love throughout every day that they're alive. And that's the problem, because doing the work of love and justice in life, in our life, is a lot like diet and exercise. It's hard work, it must be willfully undertaken every day, and it doesn't just come together because we want it to. But I think that's where knowing who we are and saying who we are can empower us to be all that we are. We might not succeed in reaching our goals of love and justice every day, but if we were ever to stop striving for them every day, we would achieve far less than we already do. Because of this lifelong task, if we ever come to think that we are fully living a life consistent with all that we believe in our hearts, I don't think we'll be having an accurate self-image, even if it's what we want to be true. Our understanding may well not fit with other people's experience of who we are. Today, whenever I'm on campus at Berkeley, I remember back to when I was a student there, and I honestly can't understand why all of those college students look at me so oddly. It's as if they seem to think that I am not one of them. They don't seem to realize that in my heart, in my own self-understanding, I don't feel all that much older than they are. So I have to conclude that they don't see me the way that I see myself, because my self-image doesn't match up with what I really look like to others. And I think if I were to ask them why they treated me like an older, middle-aged man, they would probably be baffled as to what I was talking about. Understanding who we are and articulating who we are is a journey of self-expression, and it's a journey of self-discovery. And I think it's done best when we can end up saying more of what we are for than what we are against. When we can say more of what we believe in than what we can say about what we don't believe in. We have our truest and best sense of who we are when we define ourselves not so much by what we're against, by what we're for. And I think this is one of the big problems that we liberals and progressives have been struggling with for the last year and a half. In November of 2008, we were very sure of what we were against, and we had great momentum and unity around that understanding. But February of 2009, just 3 months later, we began to realize that we were not as well unified as to what we thought the next most important thing to do might be. The many different things that we all cared for began to be competing against each other for what would get the most attention. And there were some things that we thought were going to quickly change in the domestic policy of this country, and a few of those things haven't moved forward one day since 2008. The truth is, when it came to prioritizing our goals for what we wanted in this country, we probably never had the consensus that we imagined we had. We could all agree on who our common enemies were, but we differed greatly on what our priorities were. So as we move forward in this journey at MPC, this journey of self-exploration and self-discovery, we are going to begin to ask ourselves some very particular questions in order to try out some very particular answers. So who do we think we are? Might be one of those first questions that we ask ourselves. But what do others say that we are? Might be a really good follow-up question. And we probably want to start this task by asking each other here at this church, who do you think we are at MPC? And then take a moment to listen before we jump into thinking that we know what others might say. If we listen carefully to each other, we might be surprised to discover how many different things we are right now at MPC. And that insight may even change our understanding of who we thought we have been all along. Listening to each other as we ask these questions and trying to articulate aloud the answers to those questions will be crucial in our emerging self-understanding. And perhaps listening to what others outside of our community say about who they think we are might lead us into some new insights as well. But we are not starting this journey of self-discovery from scratch. We are starting from an ending place and the beginning place at the same time. We're starting from a place that we do indeed know much better than we did 12 years ago. We know, for instance, that not only are we as individuals marvelously made, so too is our community marvelously made. The same spirit that gave us life has created life in this place as well, at this time among us, as a fellowship. And we know, too, that even as God knows each one of us and has joyful and meaningful ideas and plans for our life, so too does the Spirit of God have meaningful and joyful plans for this church. We are individuals, but in a community of faith, we are something much greater than the sum of our parts. And we also know how to begin to understand and articulate our faith, because every Sunday we end our services by reminding ourselves of what our primary task is: to go out into the world in love, to hold on to what is good, to lift up and care for the hurting and the disheartened, to return no one evil for evil. We remind ourselves to go out and take our meanings into the world based on what we deeply and truly believe inside ourselves already. And whenever we do that, we will encounter the mystery of the divine in new ways. We will hear God speaking to us in new voices. And we might even end up saying, as that woman at the well said when she encountered God in person and went to tell her friends, "Come and listen. Someone has told me everything that is in my heart, everything that I have ever done." That same Spirit who knows us already will lead us again tomorrow, as the Spirit always has. And even if we don't always say it, we still know it's true in our hearts. And that is why we call ourselves a community of faith. Amen.